Get ready to sign on the dotted line. It's another flat chat. And as the latest edition of GP Racing hits the shelves of the shops that are now actually open, we look at what's really going on with Lewis Hamilton's new contract. In this issue, we speak to George Russell, the man who might become Lewis's next teammate or Valtteri Bottas's next teammate. And we also speak to Daniel Ricciardo, the man of the moment at McLaren, amongst other things. Joining me to run these subjects and more under the microscope are, live from Australia, g'day Cobber, Mark Gallagher.
Nice to be talking to you again. I have to tell you something, Stuart. I was at an event recently and a fan came running up to me and said, "Are you Mark Gallagher from the GP Racing podcast?" Well, I have to tell you, everyone who was with me was massively impressed with my fan following here in South Australia. So there we go. The podcast does reach the remotest parts of this great continent.
Yeah, people listen, people follow, because the parlance is no longer subscribe to a podcast. You follow it, I think.
You follow it, okay.
Do you? Although Ben's shaking his head. So, also joining us, Ben Anderson, who's about to point out that I'm wrong in my parlance.
No, that was an agreement nod, even though I was nodding my head.
Well, at least people are listening, and we're not going to have to do a Formula E and resort to bringing in influencers to boost the spectacle. But anyway,
no, this is great news. This is great news, Mark, that you've been accosted by a fan, because you know it's one thing to have the silent majority who listen but don't really care about the people who are on it, but to have people come up to you and say, "Are you the man that I listen to?" That's great.
Yeah, and he was very knowledgeable too. His name is William Grounds, by the way. So, William, if you're listening, I really enjoyed our chat. And
William.
And thanks for listening, William. Yeah, exactly. So it was great, and we had a good chat about Formula One, which is more interesting than the things that I was talking about with the other group of people at the time when he came up to me. So that was
Mark.
No. So that was all really good. So yeah. Yeah, it's actually really impressive to be recognised by someone when you do an audio podcast. That's really quite impressive.
That's the scary thing about Google these days, isn't it?
When I used to do the job that Jolyon Palmer now does 10 times better on BBC Five Live, I was actually in a cafe chatting to a good friend of mine, and a Dutch couple came over, and the Dutch gentleman was actually recognising my voice, even though – unfortunately, he was born with a really profound disability, so he had no sight. He'd never been able to watch Formula One, but he'd always listened to it, and he'd listened to it all his career. And he was a massive Formula One fan, and if you think about it, it's really quite extraordinary. And he just loved Formula One. And he was on holiday in England, and he heard me talking in a cafe, and he came over and said, "Are you Mark Gallagher from BBC Five Live? Because I listen to you, online every other weekend." And it was really interesting to talk to a big fan of the sport who, you know, for obvious reasons, had never been able to watch the drama, and yet he can enjoy all of the drama of it. So it just goes to show our, in this multimedia, fully connected world, there's some pretty exceptional outcomes in terms of our ability to engage with fans.
One of the people below the line on the Autosport YouTube channel suggested that I looked like Valtteri Bottas's dad once, and I put this to Valtteri. I said,
"You don't look like Valtteri Bottas's dad."
This is what he said: "You don't look like my dad."
I agree with Valtteri.
Shall we turn our attention to the 2021 season's elephant in the room, which is what happens next with Lewis Hamilton? Both Lewis and Mercedes have claimed that they're happy with the present arrangement, which is a 1-year extension and a plan to get around the table sometime sooner rather than later this season. But are they really happy? And Mark, in your feature in this month's GP Racing, the suggestion is no, isn't it? You know, a lot of rancor behind the scenes. It's a good thing I'm not Nick Heidfeld, isn't it? Lots of rancor behind the scenes.
It is very interesting, the Hamilton saga, because it is a bit of a saga. And I think in writing the feature, the more I looked into it and the more I thought about it, it's just not the situation that should have developed. Lewis would normally have signed a new contract going on the basis of the previous occasions when he'd signed for Mercedes-Benz or re-signed for Mercedes. he would typically have had the deal done last summer, actually really quite early. You know, I think I looked back at, you know, the previous occasions when he had re-signed, and it was, you know, it was as early as Monaco. So something happened. That something, of course, being the global pandemic, that definitely caused a lot of chaos, because we didn't have those springtime races last year when you have the beginning of the silly season, and particularly a race like Monaco where everyone's in Europe, so you get a lot of the key people turn up, and you might have the Daimler people there and all that. So all of that got missed last year. So I think it is genuine that the pandemic got in the way of the negotiations. But having said that, obviously the season did then commence in July, and there were ample opportunities to sit down, probably not during a race weekend, as I think, as I said in the feature, it's never a great time during the middle of a race weekend to be talking to a driver and a team boss about a new deal. But you can always agree to stick around and spend a day in the hotel on the Monday, or, you know, catch up, you know, before the race, get in early, do the meeting on Wednesday or something like that. But for whatever reason, that just wasn't happening, and things just drifted. And then they ended up with this January 2021 negotiation over a 2021 contract. And that's very unusual, because I can't imagine for one second that someone who is as polished in his management of the business as Toto Wolff is, wants to go into any year with a driver who's not yet signed. Because as long as the deal's not agreed, there's always a potential for something to go wrong. Something untoward could happen. So that felt, it felt like it wasn't great from any perspective. And the one thing that I did share in the feature as well is that I know from just having some insight directly that there was always an intention on Lewis's side, certainly prior to 2020, there was an intention to re-sign on what's called a 2+1. So to have a 2-year extension for 2021, 2022, and then an option for a third year. So that's clearly just not happened. And I mean, I think when you read the comments that both Toto Wolff and Lewis have said about the lateness of the contract being signed, I think the vast majority of what they've said is completely true and authentic. I think they, you know, they genuinely do not want to repeat what happened this year. I think they really will sit down this summer and sort out what comes next. But it's uncharted territory. And of course, because the season has started with a clear indication that Red Bull have more than taken the fight to Mercedes, you just wonder, you know, this is probably the worst year for them to be then distracted by contract negotiations. They've absolutely got to focus on beating Red Bull Racing. But so yeah, it just feels like it all spun out of control a little bit. And there are other reasons to believe that, you know, it wasn't an entirely happy experience when you look at, you know, other things that happened, particularly during the course of January.
It looks like the compromise that nobody wanted, which sometimes can end up being the right thing, you know, as regards the budget cap. You know, it's been said many times that where Formula One pitched that, the fact that nobody was really happy means you've kind of got the right level for it. But in this situation, just feels like nobody's really got what they wanted, and they're all trying to justify it to themselves to maybe process it and then say, oh, you know, okay, well, it's not so bad because. And ultimately, it feels like, you know, Mark, you touched on this, timing is the key thing that's got away from both parties. If you remember, so many drivers did their deals for 2021 ahead of the 2020 season starting. They used that downtime caused by the onset of the pandemic and the delay to the season to get these contracts done, dusted before some of the knock-on effects of the pandemic were truly known or realised. Lewis didn't do that, preferred to focus on the championship battle, which is fine. You know, that's common practice as well. But I remember you saying to me, you know, when he clinched the championship in Turkey, you know, with that stunning drive, one of the best in his career, that was the time, you know, where his stock was at its highest. That's the time, even allowing for everything else and all the effects of the pandemic and the lack of budget and ongoing ramifications in terms of rules and future caps and all of this. That was the time to get a deal done. From Lewis's point of view, because he had the strongest negotiating hand, and everything that's happened since then has weakened his hand. You know, the impact on Daimler's finances has become more acute and more realised, more specific. Obviously, George Russell is, you know, through an accident of bad fortune on Lewis's part, contracting COVID, been able to show himself as the natural heir to the throne and the driver that Mercedes should promote as soon as they possibly can. And the longer it's gone on, the more difficult it has seemed to me for Lewis to be able to negotiate what he originally wanted before the 2020 season started. And I know Toto said, oh, we didn't use George Russell as a negotiating point, but how can you not, when you know you've got a driver that, you know, he's on your books, you'll have an option on him, no doubt, when he reaches the end of his Williams contract, and you can hire him for a fraction of the cost of Lewis Hamilton. Not that George Russell will immediately do what Lewis Hamilton does, but it means you've got a backup option and a known quantity, not an unknown quantity. And when you add all that together, plus the fact that, you know, Lewis commands the biggest salary of any Formula One driver, but the world has changed and you can't, as a company, afford or be seen to be paying that sort of fee to a racing driver. He was just never going to get what he wanted out of this negotiation, I don't think. And the one-year deal feels to me like the worst kind of compromise, in the sense that, well, let's just get 1 year over the line. I'll do it for this much and then we'll see what happens. And Lewis has been saying, okay, well, now, you know, I just want to see how it goes. I'm fortunate I've achieved everything I wanted to achieve, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's partly true, but why would you want to go into a season with such instability? Contract negotiations are always so difficult and distracting anyway. Now you've got the threat from Red Bull coming in. Finding the time to manage all of this, plus manage your energy across what's going to be an even bigger season than last season as well, it's going to be extraordinarily challenging.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, taking some of the points you made. I think, you know, it's interesting Toto saying, you know, we didn't use George Russell in the negotiation. Well, that actually had happened. It happened because George Russell drove in the Grand Prix and did such a great job. You don't actually need to say anything. It's there. It's you know, it's been done. Everyone has seen what happened. Of course, Lewis, and quite understandably his fans, would point out, well, George didn't win the race. You know, things did go wrong. And of course, Lewis has this ability, which all the greats have, that he brings luck with him. And when I say he brings luck with him, it's because he's so good at what he does. You know, he makes the most of those opportunities. The way in which he won the first Grand Prix of this season, for example, you know, despite the fact that, you know, Max had the quicker car, but Lewis is there and Lewis knows how to deliver. And I suspect that, I mean, Lewis will not be panicking because he knows how good he is. And in many respects, if this is the year when Mercedes-Benz have the second best car, they might actually come to appreciate Lewis even more, because his calmness and his racecraft and his understanding of not just how to win races, but to win a world championship will come through. Because when I saw, for example, what happened in race one to Max, I kind of thought, yeah, it's interesting. You know, Max is such a phenomenal driver, and yet there are times when you see slight rush of blood to the head. We know how he can sound on the radio at times when he gets upset about things. So if you sort of extrapolate from that and say, well, so he can get a little bit worked up in a way that perhaps Lewis doesn't do. And so Lewis maybe has a great chance this year too. It's not that he needs to prove anything anymore, let's face it, but I mean, he can maybe underline and put in italics just how good he really is, because he perhaps doesn't have the quickest car, certainly not at the moment. I think the other thing that's really interesting, Ben, is, you know, you talked about the fact that, I think we had a conversation after Turkey, that's when Lewis should have nailed the deal. And I know I've mentioned this in previous podcasts, but I don't care, I'll say it again. You know, David Coulthard has mentioned to me on a number of occasions how important it is for drivers, no matter how good they think they are, to have professional managers who represent their best interests and sometimes tell them things that they maybe don't want to hear, but there's a reason why top managers are worth every penny. And David said that to me actually about Sebastian Vettel. And I remember him saying, you know, someone maybe needed to have a chat with Seb a little bit earlier about what it was going to happen when Charles Leclerc turned up in the team, and how the balance started to shift, and that there needed to be quite an honest conversation. And it was almost like Seb didn't really see it coming. And similarly with Lewis, you kind of think that, you know, to take a name from, well, not a name from the past, he still runs an extremely good management company. You take a guy like Julian Jacoby, who managed Senna, managed Prost, and, you know, today has a great portfolio of drivers under management. Someone like Julian would have, you know, he would have been on the phone to Toto Wolff on the Monday morning after Turkey saying, we need to get the deal done by this Friday. You know, let's get this put away. The fact that that's not happened is something else that I talk about in the feature. The way that, you know, Lewis has been through professional management and ultimately now has his own entity, and he's no doubt got some very, very good people working with him. But there's a benefit to actually having independent management. In other words, a manager who's not your employee, but actually is completely independent from you, and who can have those very straight conversations. And I think it's going to be really interesting now to see what happens. I suspect that there will hopefully have been a lot of lessons learned in recent months. I, for one, would love to see Lewis go on and win an eighth world championship title. And if he doesn't do that this year, because the Red Bull team have managed to come out with a really good package, and if Red Bull Honda have the beating of Mercedes this year, I don't want to see Lewis leave Formula One at the end of this year. So actually he did need to have a multi-year contract, but now it's going to be negotiated under very, very, very different circumstances. And as you say, Ben, you know, the Daimler situation has changed. They're investing a huge amount of money in the electrification of cars. They've reduced their shareholding in the Mercedes-Benz Formula One team. So it's now a three-way split with Sir Jim Ratcliffe and his Ineos company and Toto and Daimler. So I don't think Daimler will have the appetite to ride to the rescue with a large check if Lewis wants a great deal of money. And actually, again, in the feature I talk about the fact that on the far side of this global pandemic, there will be a new normal, which is going to be, there's going to be some scarcity of resources. I think that's one of the reasons why Formula One signed up to the budget cap when they did last year. Everyone can see the writing on the wall. Last year was a financially very difficult year for Formula One. This year is actually financially difficult as well. And if what I hear is true, you know, we're not out of the woods yet with Grand Prix calendar changes and whether spectators may or may not be allowed at races really quite soon is, you know, there's a big question mark over that. And so long as Formula One keeps having to go without spectators, those rights fees, those promoters fees, and the revenue is not going to be recovering. And so it's a tough moment for anyone to be looking for a great deal of money. And it'll be really interesting to see where they get to. One thing that will be in their good stead is that the negotiating position that Toto will have taken during the winter is quite unlikely to change in Lewis's favour. So I think when they pressed the pause button on discussions for 2022 and just signed a one-year contract, I don't think an awful lot will change by this summer in favour of Toto giving way to whatever demands Lewis might have. So one suspects that when they do sit down, it's going to be a pretty quick conversation. They'll either very quickly reach terms for 2022 and beyond, or there'll be a separation. And if I was to put my money on it, I would say they will do a new deal. I think the very clever way in which the announcement of the one-year contract and included their desire to work together on long-term diversity programs was a kind of coded way of saying, yes, you know, we've only got a one-year deal, but the intention is that we're going to keep going. And Lewis has continued to say things that give you every reason to believe that he's far from done with the sport of Formula One or for driving with Mercedes. So I think it's probably been an unfortunate episode, and let's see what happens come July and August.
Yeah, just drawn out a bit longer than it needs to, I suppose. And I guess the main thing is Lewis just needs to get his head round the new normal, doesn't he? And if he can come round to that way of thinking, there's no reason why they can't continue. Like you say, Mark, really Toto holds all the cards, I think. And the fact he's got both drivers out of contract this year, a difficult situation and slightly unstable for the team, but also it means that he can slot George Russell in one of the cars almost certainly, and then he can kind of move the other pieces depending on what other decisions are made. Bearing in mind, he's also got Esteban Ocon ready to be recalled from a loan if he needs to. Obviously, other drivers will look towards that team if they can get in the car. There's a possibility that Max Verstappen can break his Red Bull contract early. So from Toto's point of view, he's got a lot more options doing it this way than if he bends over backwards to give Lewis the deal he wants now.
On that front, whenever you mention Max Verstappen and Mercedes in the same sentence, I just can't see it. It's really interesting when you talk, when you see Christian Horner throwing in a grenade or trying to throw in a grenade, saying, Max
never,
Max to Mercedes. Going back to the comments I made earlier on, Mercedes is a very different type of team from Red Bull Racing. And Max Verstappen would not find it easy to be unplugged from Red Bull and then plugged straight into Mercedes, because he wouldn't get the same degree of personalized support, I suppose is a nice way to put it, that he gets at that Red Bull. I think Mercedes are more clinical in terms of what they're looking for, and they absolutely want that consistency of delivery that Lewis brings them. And it'd be interesting. I'm not doubting for one second that Max is formidably quick. We all know he is. It's that ability to go from being good to great, of it being able to put together Grand Prix victories in a way that is so consistent that then you start to nail, championship titles. And I have a small question mark about Max in that regard. And I say that as someone who enjoys watching him race. I think he's fantastic for Formula One. But the Mercedes Max thing, I struggle with. And so, Ben, whenever you talk about George Russell going there, to me, that's a more likely evolution that really works for everyone, because I think George has got the capability, I think the mentality and the sort of cultural mindset to fit in with the team incredibly well, as he showed in that remarkable weekend that he had. So what's going to be really interesting is if we see something unexpected, such as an early announcement that George Russell has signed for Mercedes for next year. So if we got to, Canada or Austria and Mercedes suddenly announced that George Russell would be driving for them, but don't make any other comment, then you can imagine the pressure then will be, well, so who's his teammate? And Mercedes don't need to say anything. They don't need to come out and say who his teammate might be. So I'm sure behind the scenes it's going to be a really interesting few months ahead. And of course Toto will be laser focused on wanting to do the things that help his team to win this year's world championship. And that's why it is so unfortunate that he's also got to now get over this little obstacle of getting Lewis's situations tidied up for 22 and 23.
Obviously, as part of your story, you talk about, upheaval in his management team during this negotiation. So he's going into this not blind, of course, because he's very experienced. And as he said publicly, this is not his first rodeo. But he's not doing it with the same weapons and the same people in his camp as he has done in the past.
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned in the piece that he's had Mark Hines working with him for a number of years, and they've been very good friends as well as then colleagues. And I mean, I've dealt with Mark on a few things for Lewis over the last couple of years, and found him to be very easy to work with, and clearly had the full confidence of Lewis, and they were you know, very polished in the way to deal with them on anything. Now, whatever occurred, and we don't know the details, whatever occurred, Mark resigned as a director of Lewis's management company in the middle of that negotiating month of January. And whilst, I mean, you know, publicly they're saying it was all very amicable, and I suspect, you know, as good friends, they probably have more than anyone been able to, you know, normally when business relationships go sour, it can be quite difficult. But if you're friends with people, you can hopefully have those straightforward, honest conversations, and they're parted company. But it brings me back to the point I made earlier on, which is that when any sports person decides, I'm going to have a mate look after, a friend look after me, we talked about the Daniel Ricciardo situation in a previous podcast. You know, Daniel Ricciardo went through a pretty difficult time with his former manager, and who was a, you know, been a good buddy of his for many years. So you get these crunch points in relationships, and this is the reason why we have big successful sports management companies, or we have individual managers like I mentioned, Julian Jacoby, who just have that breadth of experience. And by the way, they don't need to be a yes man to you so that they get their 15% or their 10% or whatever the commission is on you, because actually they've made their money. They've got a very successful business of their own. They want to tell you the thing that's right for you. And I'll be interested to see what happens with Lewis in terms of his management, because he clearly needs to have strength and depth. And he also really needs to have someone who can have honest conversations with him, including telling him things that he may not want to hear about the realities of whether it's the way the world has changed, whether it's the type of deal that needs to be done to, you know, ensure that he finishes his career in Formula One in precisely the way he does want to finish it, and also to negotiate the long-term relationships. Because I would have thought that, as we have all expected for a long time, Lewis's future ought to be completely tied up with Mercedes-Benz, not only to have a multi-year contract and finish his career at Mercedes-Benz, but then to continue and be a brand ambassador for Mercedes into the very long term, and maybe even, you know, to have a continued involvement with the team into the to the very long term. What's to say that, you know, he couldn't be a partner or a shareholder in the team, or even consider a role in management going forward if he had the appetite to do that. So there are lots of opportunities you would imagine that are there. And to have the guy that has been at your side leave in the middle of that negotiation this winter just gone by looked like things were a little bit unsettled. This wasn't the ideal time for that to be happening.
And what do we think about George Russell? Because to my mind, he's ready to step up. He thinks he's ready to step up. You know, we've spoken to him for this issue. And the thing that always impresses me about George is that he's so self-aware and articulate and analytical and very honest and considered when you speak to him, when you ask him questions about how he approaches things. He's very open and honest with the way he approaches things. And I find that quite refreshing. There doesn't seem to be any baggage with him. And I said to him during the interview, well, people looked at what you did in that car. And obviously there are the armchair experts who say, well, that just proves that anyone can get in that car and win. And he said, firstly, well, you know, I didn't hear any of that, because quite frankly, social media is a sewer and I try and avoid it where possible. And secondly, you know, people like that, they don't see the hours I put in, you know, from the minute I got the phone call saying you're in the car to even just walking into the garage at Mercedes for the first time. He'd done an awful lot of work to prepare for that, to ensure that he did the best possible job and fitted in. And then he put in all the hours with the engineers to ensure he did a brilliant job for Mercedes so that no stone was left unturned. And then obviously, you know, what happened happened, but it wasn't his fault. And he also said that he's learned a lot from that, and also from his years at Williams, just in terms of how much energy to put in things to distribute his energy over the course of a season. So it's not, hard work is not just about putting in the hours. So one of the things that really struck me as very interesting in this interview was when he said that you can't measure the quality of your input in terms of the hours you put in. You have to ensure that the hours you put into discussions with engineers are productive and a result eventuates from them that takes the whole team forward, rather than just staying up till midnight every night looking at data. That's quantity is much less important than quality. And to have someone of that age say things like that is actually really, really impressive, isn't it?
I was impressed, like you, from reading George's comments in your interview. It sounded actually quite Hamilton-esque, the way he was talking about managing his energy through the season and trying to be as efficient as possible in terms of everything he does, leaving no stone unturned. He's obviously a really, really hard worker, which you need to be to get the most out of your ability. That bit wasn't appreciated by many people in terms of his performance at the Sakhir Grand Prix. But it would have been appreciated by Mercedes, who would have seen, you know, up close everything he put into that and what he got out of the weekend, ultimately. I've been saying for a while, before he did that race, those performances in the Williams 2019 and 2020, particularly in qualifying, really, really, really impressive, quietly impressive. You watch any of his onboards, they all... The way he drives, everything just looks so well connected, very smooth. He just looks like he's got so much spare capacity when he's driving the car. And that is a real sign of somebody who can go very, very far in Formula One. And he just has the right mentality. You know, I remember speaking to Fred Vasseur, whose team ran him in GP3, I think it was. He said before George had come into Formula One, just how impressive George was as a character, someone who's really, really hard out of the car. And when he says hard, he means he pushes relentlessly, almost Alonso-like in terms of trying to get everyone on the team to give their maximum to achieve the best result. He's obviously carried that through into Formula One. Having such an impressive performance for Mercedes in Bahrain will have given him that little bit of extra self-confidence, I think, and it will be interesting to see how that manifests this year when he's back to the grind in the Williams, if you like, because it's one thing believing you can do it, and it's another thing knowing you can. And Sakhir will have proven to George that he can do it when the spotlight's on him in the best car, in the best team. So I think he has all the ingredients to be a top driver. And now he's been able to show that, and Mercedes will have seen it firsthand and have the data available. I think it's just a matter of time before he ends up in that car. And he has, I think, on top just that little bit of emotional intelligence that maybe, and Mark alluded to this, Max slightly lacks in the heat of the moment. Obviously, George hasn't been under quite as much pressure as Max, hasn't had quite as many of these tough situations at the front of the field, and obviously was driving a much better car in the Mercedes than Max has probably had up to this point until this year's Red Bull. But George doesn't strike me as the kind of guy who loses his head in the heat of the moment or will say something perhaps slightly out of order on team radio. Max just seems a little bit more of an emotional creature. And in terms of the way Mercedes operates, I think that stands George in good stead as well. So excited to see what he can do when he finally gets another opportunity in a top car. Because I think of the new breed of British drivers we've seen come through into Formula One recently, he's the pick of the bunch.
I don't think we need to labour the point too much that Valtteri has struggled and has admitted that he struggled at times against Lewis, and there is, I think, there's definitely a psychological, you know, aspect to that, which I think George would not struggle as much. There's probably a whole series of complex reasons why that would be, but fundamentally George comes across as you said, very self-aware, but also very self-assured. He knows what he's capable of doing. And he comes across a very nice guy, but in a Toto Wolff kind of way, like a very nice guy who's got a very steely interior. And you get the impression that, you know, having been through the apprenticeship that he's had to serve at Williams, it's toughened George. You know, he's learned from his mistakes. He's been gutted when he has made any mistakes as he made in Imola, for example, last year. And so you get the sense that here's a guy who really has an impressive external perception, is very impressive of him, but actually you suspect that's only just a little bit of what the story is. There's a much deeper aspect to him. He is a very driven guy. And I mean, I think, you know, Lando Norris done an astonishing job. I wasn't a believer necessarily in Norris when he went to McLaren. Not that I didn't think he had the ability to be a quick racing driver, but I just wondered about going into McLaren at his stage in his career, and he's really risen to it very, very well. George, I think, is on a different trajectory again, and it ought to be a completely done deal, indeed, if it isn't already done, that he is going to move to Mercedes-Benz. If I know anything about Jos Capito, the new chief executive at Williams, he will fully understand the asset that George Russell represents. And I would imagine some of the quite early meetings that Jos Capito and Simon Roberts, the team principal at Williams, have had when Jos joined was, what is the situation with George Russell? How do we keep him? Can we stop Toto taking him away? Because if you were trying to think of a strategy for pulling Williams forward, the last thing you'd want to do is to lose your prized asset in George, because he is so formidable. But I suspect that ship has probably already sailed. And when George steps on board his Mercedes and starts his contract there, whether that's as teammate to Lewis, whether that's his teammate to someone else, I suspect we're in for a very exciting chapter for, you know, British Formula One fans.
Yeah, we'll go on to McLaren in a minute, because obviously, you know, we've talked about the leading teams. We should cover the ones that are following immediately in their wake. But you make a very good point there about Williams there, Mark, because they do need an A caliber driver in there, don't they? Which, bless him, Nicholas Latifi is not quite out the top draw. You know, he's a smart guy. He's ballpark quick. He's fine. He's got a good attitude, but he's probably not the person to bring that team forward, apart from, you know, the money his dad's putting in.
Yeah, and you know, the thing is that without the benefit of a crystal ball, what I'm about to say is pure speculation. But if reading everything that we read about Porsche and Volkswagen Audi and Porsche's interest in synthetic fuels and Formula One's move towards synthetic fuels, and the fact that Williams have not only brought Jost in, who came from Volkswagen Motorsport, but also he's now recruited technical director from Volkswagen. You'd have to say, how long will it take for Jost Capito to try and stitch a deal together whereby we get a very big announcement that Porsche is coming back into Formula One and actually coming in with Williams? Because there is precisely the kind of deal that Jos Capito has been employed to deliver for the shareholders at Williams for Darlington Capital. You know, he's got a team principal to look after all the day-to-day running of the Formula One business. So what's the really big strategic move that Jost as chief executive could have for Williams? Well, that would be to get a car manufacturer to come to Grove. The facilities which were, you know, built while they were in partnership with BMW, so it was completely state-of-the-art 15 years ago, so it'll need a refresh, it'll need an upgrade, but actually everything is kind of there for them to build that team as they want to, as a fully-fledged manufacturer team. So you can imagine, you know, there'll be lots of balls being juggled here. So can Jost, you know, somehow convince Volkswagen and Porsche to do a deal sooner than later that he could then take to George? And actually, does he have the contractual ability to keep George away from Mercedes-Benz? I somehow doubt it. But that's the kind of, you know, thinking about the kind of the machinations that go on. You know, Jost will be trying to put together a formidable deal for Williams so that when you get to the new engine regulations in the middle of this decade, that Williams are a works team. And of course, he'll know that George is the guy to deliver results for him. But it's too far away for George. That's the difficulty. So he can't be hanging around for 22, 23, 24, waiting for Williams to become the exciting prospect that could win the world championship. So I suspect, you know, it is probably a foregone conclusion, but this is all part of the interesting backstory to Formula One, what's going on to create the capability of teams like Williams. And we're going to talk about McLaren in a minute, you know, those well-established teams of days gone by to bring them back to the fore in Formula One. And that's a really interesting story to watch develop.
Yeah, when you're a driver like George, you really have to seize your moment, don't you? And yeah. Rather than park your ambitions for a few years. But
that moment's now, isn't it? He'll be saying to you, call me in 3 years' time, and it'll cost you a bit more as well to get me back.
because I'll be a double world champion by then. And and that's how it should be, you know. I think that's what makes it very exciting. The reality is that, I guess, as I've said in a recent column in the magazine, you know, the sports arguably never had stronger leadership when you look down the field, possibly with the exception of Haas. And I don't say that because Gunther Steiner is not a great team principal. He is. I think the thing with Haas that strikes me is I don't think Gunther has enough great people around him in the senior leadership roles that he needs, just as much as anything because of the business model that Haas runs to as a team. But by and large, you know, front to the back of the grid, we've got a pretty formidable lineup of team bosses and chief executives now, and they're all trying to work the angles. And this is where the Lewis Hamilton factors and the George Russell factors are so important, because when you're trying to put together that jigsaw of how can I move my team forward to the front of the grid, drivers like that are a really big chunky piece of that picture. And that's why they have, you know, so much value attached to them.
Well, we did promise we'd speak about McLaren, and they're the epitome of a once great team that is hoping to restore those glory years. And, you know, it has been a long time, hasn't it? You think that Sergio Perez, now moving to Red Bull as his last throw of the dice, is a veteran driver. He moved to McLaren as a young hopeful and a highly regarded hot prospect in 2013. And that was really when it all went wrong for McLaren. They'd gone for a new car concept and nothing went well for them after that for years and years, because that was 2013. So this is a team that hasn't won since, what, 2012, I think?
Last race of 2012, yeah. Mm. The race that Nico Hülkenberg should have won.
Yes.
Mark's former team. But he got wiped out by Lewis Hamilton, didn't he? So
yeah. Rare blunder for Lewis. So yeah, and by then, Lewis had already decided to leave McLaren because he was already getting disgruntled with the way things were. But there was that famous instance where his gearbox failed in Singapore because there was sand left in the cast from the casting process. And he just sort of thought, well, you know, sod it, I can't be bothered with this. I'm never going to win a race again if I hang around with these clowns. And got back on the phone to Niki Lauda and sorted himself out a Mercedes deal, and the rest is history. But now it seems that through an awful lot of pain, McLaren are going places. Daniel Ricciardo had the option to go to McLaren in 2018 when he was considering his options at Red Bull. And he said he spoke to Zak Brown and other people, but they didn't really sell him the dream, which is quite an amazing admission. It was a fascinating part of the interview we did for this issue. And so now that time has come. And he did say that one of the key figures has been Andreas Seidel, who has come in as team principal. Now, it's important to emphasize that Seidel isn't the person who is solely responsible for the McLaren renaissance we're seeing. There was kind of the early shoots of new growth. There was a momentum developing, certainly on the technical side. But it does seem like Seidel has been kind of the final piece of the puzzle that's made it all work together. And he came highly recommended by fellow Aussie Mark Webber, who worked with him at Porsche. So Ricciardo thought this really is the time to go there. And it seems to be that things are coming together there. Although, you know, Ricciardo had a few issues in Bahrain on the technical side, and he's been struggling a little bit with the braking system. This does seem to be kind of like a partnership that's been waiting to happen for some time.
Yeah, it looks like a nice fit, I would say. As you mentioned, something that's been, and is kind of the title of our piece, you know, a love affair years in the making. I mean, your story references an anecdote that Ricciardo told, you know, during the launch season, you know, back when teams, including McLaren, were doing their best to dress up livery launches as massive media events. We appreciated the need for some theatre, but Ricciardo talked about how, you know, he knew of McLaren from his youngest days, and he talks in your feature about, you know, when he was growing up in Australia, it was McLaren or Ferrari. They were the two beasts. And he has memories of, I think, watching Senna race at the last, watching Senna win for the final time in Formula One at Adelaide. So obviously McLaren is quite a special team to Daniel, as I guess Ferrari is, you know, and there were often links made between him and Ferrari and, you know, his Italian heritage, etc. So you can understand that. So I think it's a really cool story for Formula One that he's finally kind of completed the circle, if you like, and gone to a team that's kind of close to his heart. Maybe isn't the highest performing team of the moment, but nevertheless, in the shrewd sense, one that is gaining serious momentum and is getting back towards the sharp end again. I think 2018 was probably a bit too soon. Obviously, the Honda deal was done by then, but McLaren was still coming out of, I guess, what Zach Brown would call the Darth Vader years. And they hadn't quite yet gone through their transformation into the sort of, you know, the sunny, happy, more brightly coloured McLaren team that you see now. Not saying they're not a serious racing operation, because clearly they are, but they have this kind of slightly more relaxed feel about them, you know, shedding the Honda baggage, shedding the Alonso baggage, shedding the Ron Dennis baggage. I think quite important for the team to go through that pain, if you like, and almost be reborn as a team that didn't see itself as a fallen giant that should and deserved and automatically should be at the front, but rather a team that had dropped to the midfield and needed to go through a period of soul searching and rebuilding. And that was really just commencing in 2018. Whereas now you've seen the fruits of that labour and that challenge, and McLaren looked like the team that, well, they finished third in the championship last year and they could well do so again. There's a chance when Mercedes, Red Bull slip up, as they inevitably will do in a season as long as this, you know, Daniel Ricciardo will be one of the drivers front and centre, ready to snap up podiums or race victories if the opportunity should arise. So a decent move, a step up for him from Renault, I think. I know in your feature, Codders, Weber castigates Ricciardo for cashing out by signing for Renault over McLaren, but I don't think it did any harm for him to leave Red Bull, having, you know, been there for so long, spread his wings, join a new team, have that different feel of what it's like to go into a new environment, try to motivate people around you, try to be the guy that the team builds around, tries to focus on. He can now take that experience to McLaren, hopefully push them on another level with his experience and some different ideas, and obviously also provide a race-winning proven yardstick for the team to measure Norris against, because you know, the last couple of years they've been a team with kind of two younger drivers looking to prove themselves. Sainz is as good as he is, and it's great that he's now got his big shot at Ferrari. You know, he's not and hasn't yet been at the same level or achieved the same things Ricciardo has. So I think it's a good move that works all round. And Ricciardo, with his heart on your sleeve, happy-go-lucky, sunny personality, I think he fits really well with how McLaren seem to be at the moment. So yeah, a nice feel-good story, I think, to start the Formula One season with.
Do we think that Ron Dennis would call baggage baggage, or would he call it, I don't know, a hand-drawn accoutrement transportation vessel?
System.
Yes.
Yeah, I think you need to practice your Ron speak there. I think it's the words system and optimal are usually included in any description. So yeah, it'd be an optimal personal freight transportation system, probably, is what a handbag is. Or
why well, use one word when five will do?
Exactly. On the Daniel Ricciardo front, while I was thinking about his move to McLaren a couple of weeks ago, I decided to go down to a local winery here in South Australia called St. Hugo Winery, because they are making the Daniel Ricciardo wine, which is being marketed as DR3. It's a very nice Shiraz or a Cabernet Sauvignon, pretty full-bodied. I don't know if it's good at overtaking, but it's a very fine wine.
Ricciardo's doing all sorts of marketing things now. He cropped up on my copy of FIFA 21. He's, really? He's done some deal with them. Yeah, with EA, yeah. EA Sports. Yeah, he appears in the – they have this thing – for people who don't know the game franchise, this thing called Volta Football, which is a kind of street-style soccer with three players. And it's been part of the FIFA franchise for a few editions now. And Ricciardo pops up on that aspect of the game. So he's everywhere. He's doing fashion shoots. He's doing European football games. He's doing wines.
He'll be doing pencil cases next.
Yeah, indeed. What isn't he doing?
Yeah, I mean,
do you know, if you go to Ferrari World Abu Dhabi, you can buy a Ferrari branded camel, a toy, like a little stuffed camel.
Oh, I thought you meant an actual camel.
Not an actual camel.
You know, the Ricciardo move to McLaren is a fascinating one, because Mark Webber is not the only person who described his move to Renault as cashing out. And I think there were quite a few people who know Daniel who were concerned about that move, because it was almost suggesting that he was throwing in the towel with ever having a chance to win the world championship, because he clearly wasn't going to do that at Renault. So the McLaren move is a good one, because it suggests that, yes, he did cash out at least for a time, but actually what's wrong with that? Because it means that he's now got all the money that he will ever need behind him, so he can relax about his financial well-being. He'd probably never have to work again if he doesn't want to when his Formula One career finishes. So he's in a different place when he joins McLaren. He's kind of he's been there in terms of making the lucrative moves in his career. So he now has this opportunity at McLaren to help Andrea Seidel and Zak Brown achieve what they want, which is podium finishes, and as Ben, as you've just said, to get that possibly to get an elusive Grand Prix victory on a day when Mercedes and Red Bull perhaps both trip up. And he's certainly the man capable of doing that because of his experience at Red Bull Racing. I think there are still things that Daniel says and does which just make me pause and wonder about the hunger factor and the focus. Because as we all know, and we've just been, you know, we're talking about Lewis, we've been talking about George Russell, and I just made the point about the steeliness that you have within these guys who want to win the world championship. Now, I think Daniel Ricciardo is a very serious professional, but I'm taking my life in my hands when I say this, given that I'm in Australia. But when I read a story online about the fact that, you know, he says one of the benefits of driving for McLaren might be that he could get Zak to allow him to do the Indy 500 or to, you know, maybe he could race in Bathurst. Just get rid of all of that off the table. Just ignore all of those. That's just all distraction. He doesn't need any of that. Daniel needs to just focus on the one thing which he needs to nail, which is to get the McLaren onto that podium and for himself to, and for him to absolutely assert his number one status in the team against Lando Norris. And that's not going to be the work of a moment, because Lando is not about to be a walkover. And again, in the opening race in Bahrain, as we know, Daniel had some issues, but nevertheless, Lando Norris drove an extremely strong race. So, you know, I think, again, with Daniel, all the capability is there, and it just needs that next step in terms of pushing through to give himself the chance to be the one who nicks the win. Because if he has a season at McLaren now in which whenever Mercedes or Red Bull trip up, it's Lando Norris who nicks that win, you know, that's not going to be the outcome that he wants. So he has to assert his status within the team. And certainly, you know, you're right, Ben, what you said, McLaren is a very different looking team today than it ever was before. I just did a recent piece of work on looking through all the sponsors who are in Formula One today. So 241 sponsors and technical partners of the 10 Formula One teams. Numerically, the largest number are with McLaren. And that shows you the job that Zak Brown has done since actually the end of 2016. So it was kind of 2015, 2016 when McLaren lost their final of their long-standing partners, companies like, you know, they lost Tag Heuer to Red Bull, they lost ExxonMobil to Red Bull Racing.
Boss as well. Sorry? Been with them for 30 years.
Hugo Boss went to Mercedes-Benz. So, you know, the Ron Dennis, Ekram Sami being the former commercial boss of McLaren during the Ron Dennis years, you know, their portfolio of sponsors effectively all fell by the wayside during the early stages of that uncompetitive phase that started in 2012. But now, under Zak, you know, they've got 44 technical partners and sponsors. And it's an impressive roster. When you look at even some of the companies here are apparently quite small sponsors of McLaren. They are very large companies in their own right. So they've got this incredibly strong sponsorship portfolio, which they need to have because the automotive company within Mercedes-Benz have been through Armageddon during the pandemic, and the automotive business at McLaren was actually holding up the group in the previous year. As we know, the McLaren F1 team has they've had a shareholding sold. So there's been a kind of reworking of the shareholding in the Formula One team, again, to shore up the finances there. So quite a few things that have happened to McLaren, even in recent months during the pandemic. But you look at it today and you think, well, McLaren, Mercedes, very strong package, certainly well capable of finishing, you know, third in the world championship, you would think. And, you know, if you had to put money on, is Daniel Ricciardo going to win a race or is Sebastian Vettel going to win a race at Aston Martin? Actually, you'd say maybe Daniel's got a bigger opportunity.
We'll be looking at the technical issues behind Mercedes and Aston Martin being pegged back in our next issue. But we should probably close on a more positive note because I think we're coming up to our hour, despite our clock being interrupted by our system dying mid-broadcast. But we've had a very interesting rookie start this year, someone who's so short that they've had to modify the pedals so that he can reach them, and a really, really exciting new talent, and that's Yuki Tsunoda, only 20 years old. And our columnist Ben Edwards thinks that he's got the potential to develop into Japan's most successful Formula One driver yet. And which, because, you know, you can say that because the Red Bull young driver program takes them in young, breaks them young, and leaves them wrecked and having to cash in their pension age 22. So hopefully, though, that won't happen to him. But, you know, Yuki really, really has had a rocket ascent through the junior ranks. And based on what he's done so far, even if he's not comfortable in the car yet, you've got to say that Tsunoda's doing a pretty awesome job, don't you?
Yeah, very impressive. I think so far, all the faith that Red Bull is showing in him seems justified. It sounds like Helmut Marko hasn't been this excited about one of their prospects since probably Verstappen. And it seems like there's been quite a lot of similarity in the way they've progressed so quickly. Obviously, Tsunoda's done a bit more in the junior single-seater formulas than Max did before making it to Formula One. But I think I'm right in saying Tsunoda didn't do as much racing beforehand. You know, whereas Max obviously was steeped in it from, you know, the day he was born and taken through the karting ranks by his father. I don't think Tsunoda had much in the way of a karting background. So extremely impressive the way he's come through. Everyone says he's, you know, not only incredibly quick, but has this great attitude, really adaptable, very quick learner. So he's not going to be wasting much time getting up to speed or needing, you know, several races or seasons to kind of find his feet. I think he's kind of straight there. Seems like Pierre Gasly's quite impressed with how quick he's been already. So exciting times for Red Bull, really, because I think they've had a bit of a, with no disrespect intended to the likes of Alex Albon and Pierre Gasly, Red Bull have had a bit of a dry time with their junior program in recent seasons. A few duds, a few missteps, They always talk about how robust the program is, and obviously, you know, it has it's a long-standing, well-proven program for progressing drivers through to Formula One, and they do have a lot of very good drivers on it. But I think some of them haven't quite turned out to be what they hoped, and certainly not what they need in terms of an A-list driver for the top team, someone to either replace Verstappen eventually or certainly give him a really hard time. And of course, that's why they've turned to Perez this year. But it looks like Tsunoda is probably the guy, if he continues on this current trajectory, who will be able to emulate Max and end up either alongside him, pushing him harder than maybe his other teammates have so far, or taking over from him if he decides to move on.
I think the point you make about the Red Bull program is very good, because you know it has been a robust program. They've achieved a lot with it, but I mean, you have to say Helmut has had dozens of drivers to choose from. Sooner or later, you're going to strike gold, aren't you? If you know, throw enough at it, you're going to have someone emerge. You know, if you had that amount of money, you'd sooner or later find someone with the talent. And actually, in Tsunoda, I didn't know a lot about him, actually, you know, before he came into the season. I mean, he started karting actually relatively young. He was in single figures. I think he started karting for fun when he was 8 or 9. He was racing for a professional team in karting when he was about 10. You know, won in Formula 4, finished third in the Formula 2 championship. You know, looked really quite good. But the thing is, we've seen talented Japanese drivers before. What's really striking about this young guy is he gets into the Formula 1 team and he looks completely unfazed. He's got such a great personality. He's taken the car by the scruff of the neck. And I was watching Bahrain and I was thinking, my goodness, the ticket orders for Suzuka must be going off, you know, the scale. I mean, not only is Max Verstappen driving a Red Bull Honda, you know, and it's the fastest car they see, they've got a local hero. They've got Tsunoda, and he's also got a Honda in the back of that car. And by the way, the AlphaTauri is a pretty handy piece of kit as well. So actually add the whole thing together, and it's properly exciting. And, you know, being a bit old-fashioned, I always like the fact that, you know, there's a prospect that you might actually turn up at a race like Suzuka and Tsunoda sticks it on the front row of the grid. You know, that's kind of the prospect that there is. You know, he'll have done so many, you know, done so many laps there, and, you know, that there'll be the whole kind of fan factor. So Tsunoda is properly exciting for Formula One. And I mean, he's so young and enthusiastic. I mean, I'm sure he's finding the whole experience just quite extraordinary. But so far, anyway, looks incredibly calm and accepting this opportunity, taking it with both hands. And let's hope it continues, because it will be great, won't it, if we have that kind of Gasly Tsunoda force to be reckoned with, mixing it, you know, in the top six consistently, and again pushing for those podium finishes on a day when Mercedes or Red Bull is maybe not quite there. And again, I hasten to add, I actually think, you know, the AlphaTauri with that Honda engine, there might just be days, there might just be weekends where it's actually the car to have. You know, it could be the breakthrough, you know, opportunity for Honda as much as Red Bull Racing is. So there's a lot to be thankful for from seeing Tsunoda come in, and it's great to have just another story to add to the wide range of things that we get to look forward to in Formula One at the moment.
The first driver born in the year 2000 to race in F1, I think.
Yeah.
Just to make us all feel very old.
Oh, yeah. When he's postman and policeman looking young as well.
Yeah, he was 9 months. I think he was 9 months old when Kimi made his Formula One debut. Which is pretty extraordinary stuff. By the way, gentlemen, I know this isn't very helpful to the podcast listeners, but my glamorous assistant has just brought me, just to show you, a bottle of the Daniel Ricciardo.
D3R.
Yeah, so there we go. Shall I bring some bottles back to the UK with me for us to sample?
That's an excellent idea.
In a post-lockdown editorial meeting of some.
Yes, very good.
Yeah. Oh yes.
Product review for our
product review.
I had some of Jarno Trulli's wine once and it was exceptional.
I was told it was only exceptional for about the first 10 minutes and then it just started to complain about the setup.
one glass wonder.
Someone did end up projectile vomiting in the restaurant toilet. So I don't know whether the Trulli wine was involved in that. But
I see. When you met him, sorry. So when you met the Arnold Trulli, someone ended up projectile vomiting in the toilet.
Wine back.
I see. Sorry.
The wine was bought and paid for and imbibed in this restaurant. I was working as a freelancer and we were all taken out because the project we'd been working on was such a tremendous success that as a Christmas treat, everyone in this department was taken out for a slap up dinner in this Italian restaurant in Chelsea or somewhere with the Jarno Trulli wine as the accompaniment. But it turned out that one of the younger people who worked as an assistant to one of the commercial people was not someone who drank much. And we certainly found out why. And whoever had to clean up the toilet afterwards certainly found out why. Anyhow, well, there's a way to end a podcast, isn't there? There's plenty more in this month's issue of GP Racing, which I
non-toilet sick stories, I might add.
In non-toilet sick story news. And great, and it's on the shelves now, as I said, in shops that are now reopened, certainly in the UK. Also, should have landed by now on subscribers' doorsteps, although my copy only arrived yesterday, which is slightly annoying because yesterday was not Monday and you should have had it on Monday. But then again, Mrs. Codling did receive a Christmas card from a relative in Northern Ireland at the beginning of March. So it's all the post's fault. There's plenty more in this month's GP Racing. No toilet sick stories. Mark's superbly crafted and suitably flat out tribute to Murray Walker is in it. And because there's no such thing as too many pictures of old buses being converted as F1 car transporters, we begin a new multi-part story by Damien Smith covering the history of Lotus. It's brilliant. We've just been looking. Well, Ben's reviewed the layout of part two this morning. I'll be having a look at it after we've finished recording this podcast. And we've also, in old news, we've got the Now That Was a Car feature, or NTWAC, as we call it internally, is the Brabham BT46 fan car, which was never banned. The so-called banned car that was never banned, had many fans. There's a rhyme in there somewhere. Great car, fantastic story, and very interesting to look into its history, and lovely photographs as ever by James Mann, who's done a storming job of keeping us supplied while no events have been on. But we've been having, just behind the scenes, having to consider our options for future NTWACs because the cupboard is running slightly dry. We're looking forward to more historic events coming up where we can send James out, and he's veritably chomping at the bit to actually get out of his Dorset farmstead or wherever he lives and actually shooting some cars again. But anyway, thanks to my guest Mark Gallagher, who's not going to open that bottle of DR3 wine right now.
No, I'll make sure to keep that cork in and bring it back for some imbibing with your good selves in early summer, hopefully.
Good man.
I hope it travels well. Thank you, Ben Anderson, for your sagacity.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.
So, you know, most people say sagacity really sarcastically. I'm glad I, you know, didn't say
you really held yourself together then. It's the most disciplined moment on the podcast from you, I think.
Thanks to you for listening. And thanks also to our long-suffering producer, Martin Lee, who, as we know, is tasked with the onerous job of assembling a workable hour or so's podcast from our libelous nonsense month in, month out. So that's it from us. Thanks again for listening. We'll speak to you next month.